Case, United States against Blazier. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Judge Efron, honorable judges. May it please the court. We're here today because the testimonial hearsay that was disclosed to the members in appellant's trial was so intertwined with Dr. Pappas' testimony that it violated the Confrontation Clause and did not satisfy the bounds of MRE 703 and 705. I'd like to begin by highlighting to this court's attention the opinion of the D.C. Court of Appeals in Gardner, which was issued this summer. And the reason why I'd like to point the court's attention to that particular case is for a couple of reasons. First of all, in Gardner, it was interesting that the United States attorney in that case first conceded that the confrontation of a substitute analyst was in violation of the Confrontation Clause. There were two analysts that testified in that case that had no personal role or personal knowledge of the actual testing done in the case. The second concession from the United States attorney was the fact that the reports were testimonial hearsay. There was a serology report and DNA report both admitted at trial.
Were they dealing with the lab reports out of the Armed Forces lab?
They were not, Your Honor. There was a FBI.
Where were those lab reports prepared that they were dealing with?
It was an FBI serology report and then a private laboratory that the FBI contracted with for DNA analysis. But what was interesting about the Gardner analysis was the fact...
Given that the government conceded so much, what presidential value, what value does Gardner have to us?
The analysis that Gardner went on to complete about why the government in that case, let me step back a point, argued the fact that the data that was admitted at trial was not for the truth of the matter asserted, but was in fact... just the basis, the underlying basis of the expert's opinion. And I think that's ties directly into the second specified issue from this court. And what Gardner seemed to point to is the fact that the experts that testified in that case repeatedly and directly referred to and disclosed to the member, or the jury, the testimonial hearsay that was contained in those reports.
Are all lab reports testimonial, in your view?
There are aspects, and I think it would depend on a case-by-case, fact-by-fact determination to decide whether...
The answer is not all lab reports are testimonial.
There are some instances where there may be a lab report that is not testimonial, but from
In this case, we're dealing with, and I'm seeing if you agree with the categorization or not, I see at least four categories of material that we're dealing with. We have the August 16th, whatever the August 16th thing is.
The cover memorandum.
July 10th consent, your analysis, the June 5th, your analysis, and I would add to the category the at least one document that has some handwritten material on it. Okay, so at least four categories of things, of lab reports or information, which you may view as one category, which is equals all testimonial, but is it fair to say that that is at least a way to break down the material into categories?
That is fair to say, Your Honor.
Is it your view that they are all testimonial?
It is my view that there are definitely documents within each one of these categories that are testimonial, so that there are all four categories that, as Your Honor has broken out, do contain testimonial hearsay. For example, and again, kind of tying into a little bit of what Gardner addressed, on page 157 of the joint appendix, and I think this goes to maybe the fourth category that Your Honor highlighted, there were handwritten notes on the Form 2624, which basically accompanies the post-drug testing reports. And there's a certification at the bottom of that page, which a laboratory certifying official, the LCO, signed. Dr. Pappa directly testified as to that page, as to that certification that appeared, and he also then directly testified to the members about the handwritten notes. Those handwritten notes were explaining on that particular page what drugs appellant's sample were positive for. That was not something that was generated by the machine. That was a statement by the person that was completing that form and then signing the certification at the bottom.
So what?
I'm sorry?
So what?
Well, what it is it's just one example of the fact that the...
Well, I'm trying to get to the crux of this, which is, so what? So there's testimonial hearsay. So Papa testified. How does that violate the Confrontation Clause? Melendez-Diaz basically doesn't give us much guidance, except insofar as it's negative guidance that not everyone who apostolically lays hands on the stuff has to testify. Okay. So who does have to testify? And why isn't Papa okay?
The declarants would be to be the ones that testify. And I think what this goes to is a little bit of what's touched in Melendez-Diaz and some of the state courts that we've seen post-Melendez-Diaz addressing similar issues. And that goes to the opportunity to confront the analyst and weed out the incompetent or fraudulent analyst. And there's...
Well, aren't you really getting more out of Papa than you would have gotten out of the person who turned the switch and swished the stuff around? Papa doesn't run the lab, but he's a person with substantial expertise who knows this stuff cold. The person who turns the switch and swishes the stuff can testify that he turned the switch and swished the stuff, and that's about it. What are you going to get out of him?
I want to highlight, I think in particular, GCMS runs when it comes to address your honors questions. With the GCMS runs, there's more than just an individual who has a high school degree flipping a switch. There's a certified chemist who's actually performing that test, who's trained in the procedures, who has to monitor the solvent levels if they have to inject. They have to monitor the peaks and the graphs to ensure that there's accurate data. So what Melendez-Diaz and some of these other cases tell us, and I'd like to highlight the Brewington opinion out of North Carolina, it talks about the what ifs, because Dr. Papa had to rely on the ifs. And he testified that he had to rely on the ifs. If it was followed according to procedure, if the procedures were properly accounted for, did the analyst try to do anything? What if the analyst tried to hide a mistake? And I think this court's opinion in Luke highlights the problem with when you have a fraudulent analyst who's trying to cover and hide their mistake. What we don't want to do is have another Mr. Mills. And by just confronting Dr.
Well, is the government responsible for engaging in an independent investigation of each laboratory test that it wants to introduce at trial to determine whether there's been fraud?
I'm not sure that necessarily it needs to go that far, Your Honor.
Then what's to be gained by having every person who touched the sample testify?
I think that's where footnote 1 of Melendez-Diaz is applicable, where the Supreme Court recognized that it doesn't take necessarily everybody. But if the government chooses to put in substantive evidence that contains testimonial hearsay, then the way to do that is through the testimony of live witnesses. And I think that's the part of the issue that we have in heart, and part of Your Honor's question, is it may be, in this case and on the facts of this case, the government chose to put in the entire drug testing reports. It contained the statements and the conclusions and the certifications from the LCOs, from the quality reviews, from the testing analysts to say that this run was okay. When the government chose to make that step and to put in those statements, then there's only one way to satisfy the Confrontation Clause, and that's to call the actual declarants that made those statements. And that's why Dr.
It was your view that the July 10th and June 5th reports are affidavits, or is it your view that they are created under circumstances which would lead an objective witness reasonably to believe blah, blah, blah?
I think it falls into that latter category, although there are certain things, again, it's kind of hard, there are a couple of things within these documents, both the 10 July and 5 June, which would fall under
affidavits.
You're playing
it safe, but are you asserting that they're affidavits or not?
For example, I will say the 2624, the certification at the bottom would be, in essence, like an affidavit. A lot of the other remainder of the statements would fall into that third category that the objective witness would reasonably believe. And that ties back into what Dr. Papa explained the purpose of the lab is in pages 35 and 36 of the joint appendix of his testimony, where he said it's for forensically defensible results to be used in legal proceedings. And that's kind of what sweeps it into this broad category that is the third category of testimonial hearsay and statements that are not allowed.
So let's take the June 5th report, which is a unit sweep. It's your view that's testimonial, not the report, the sheet with the stuff on it and then the person certifying at the bottom.
The 2624 does contain testimonial hearsay of that particular one. It again, because...
And it's testimonial hearsay because...
Because at that point, the lab and the lab employees are generally aware of the fact of what would happen to positive results.
It's unit sweep.
As far as... I'm looking at...
So do all positive results go to a court-martial?
No, Your Honor.
Most positive results?
I don't have those numbers and those specific facts in front of me as far as whether they would all go to court-martial or not. But
what if you happen to know, as then this is a hypothetical, that only 1% of positive results went to court-martial and 99% went to administrative or unit leadership discipline, et cetera, some other box of military discipline or even just medical care? What does that do to your argument? You're not conceding that, mind you.
No, I'm not, Your Honor.
That's the scope of your argument by creating a harsh hypothetical.
I would still make that same argument because of the fact that the lab employees know that they have forensically defensible results. The whole reason to have forensically defensible results is so they could withstand the test in a court of law. So I would argue that even though maybe using the hypothetical only 1% actually went to trial, the lab employees, and again, it's looking at the fact of would an objective witness reasonably believe that these are statements were produced under the circumstances for trial. Also to take into account the format in which the two documents, or the four categories of documents are submitted to trial, are assembled in that manner for the purposes of trial.
Counsel, I have a question to ask you about the joint appendix of pages 317 to 476. Which I believe comprise the two drug testing reports themselves.
Yes, Your Honor.
What is your position with respect to the pages within those reports that consist solely of computer-generated graphs and charts and numbers?
When you take a look at these graphs, they are produced by a machine and by the computer, the GCMS.
Do you agree that one? Could, and I realize that may not be what happened in this case, but that those graphs and charts reflect the presence of drug metabolite in the urine in this case.
That could be one argument to make with these graphs.
Well, I'm not making an argument. I'm asking you a question with respect to your position about the graphs.
There are some graphs, and I think it's boiling down, if I understand Your Honor's question correctly. There are some graphs that do come back with negative results because those are the negative controls and negative blind quality controls that the lab uses in addition to testing member samples. So not all of the graphs that were admitted at trial reflect a positive result.
No, and I understand that, but what I'm saying is some of the graphs reflect the positive result in this case. Some of them reflect the blind controls. Some of them reflect tests done to make sure that the machines are running properly and are calibrated correctly. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what is your position with respect to those portions of the drug testing packages as to whether they are or are not testimonial and why?
And I don't know if this will go directly, but to take a step back, it's hard to look at the graphs in a vacuum.
I'm asking you to take a position with respect to computer-generated results within the drug testing packages.
And again, a computer is not a person that can make a statement. However, taking that step back, they don't operate in a vacuum. There is the human involvement that goes up to the point that the graphs are produced.
Start with a yes or no answer, though. Are those testimonial or not?
The graphs are computer generated, so there is an argument to be made they are not testimonial.
No, but I know one could make that argument. What argument are you making?
I'm going to say that they are not because they are computer generated. But again, it's looking at the package in its entirety, not just the
graphs. You're not conceding the rest of the package. I'm trying to get you to give a crisp answer there, though.
No, Your Honor. As far as the rest of the package, And the fact of the matter is these graphs are entirely dependent on the analyst's training and experience and ability to operate the machines. Again, they are certified chemists that do that, so it's not somebody that's just simply pushing a button. And when they look at those results, then they go back and annotate any problems in the run logs. And Dr. Pappas specifically...
But those are different documents, right?
They are, correct.
And you don't disagree that Dr. Papa in part relied on the actual underlying data generated by the machines. You don't disagree with that, do you?
I do not disagree with the fact that he reviewed those as part of preparing himself and testimony for trial, but I don't believe that was the sole basis of what he reviewed.
I'm not asking you if that was the sole basis. I'm asking you if that was one of the things that he relied upon in forming his opinion.
That is just one of the things he did rely on in forming his opinion. But what the court seemed to say, and where the court seemed to draw the line, and again, dealing with 703 and 705, it, I guess, pertains to the rest of the packets as well, where Dr. Papa then started linking things on the graphs and some of the handwritten notes that are on the graphs to the analyst testing the run logs.
What is your position with respect to the validity of an expert opinion if it relied only on the computer-generated graphs?
Do you understand
my
question correctly? That the only thing that the expert in that hypothetical situation that reviewed was the graphs themselves.
Well, that's the only thing that he said that he reviewed. It's the only thing he talked about. He came in and said, "I've reviewed all the computer-generated results that underlay the result in this case, and it's my expert opinion based on this information that there was drug metabolite in the accused urine."
I think you have a very different situation than what occurred in this particular case, and I think that you're looking more at kind of what the Washington and Turner and Moon opinions looked at. But again, what you have here is Dr.
Well, let me ask that a different way. Okay. What if it was settled and not disputed that the only thing he relied on was non-testimonial evidence?
Well, that 703 gives him the ability to testify about what he relied upon for the basis of his opinion.
And so in this case, and when you get up on rebuttal, could you provide the court with the instances in the record where, in your view, he is relying on testimonial as opposed to non-testimonial evidence?
I can give a couple examples right now, Your Honor, and I see that my time is up, so I don't know if you'd prefer that I wait for rebuttal or just give a couple.
You can go ahead and answer that question now, and then on rebuttal, you don't need to answer that now. On rebuttal, could you address in particular, since you started with Gardner, what the D.C. Court of Appeals said in Gardner about the potential for having an expert testify in that situation? But go ahead and answer Judge Erdman's question now, please.
And then I have another thing I want her to do on rebuttal, if you don't mind.
Okay. Why don't you give that now, and then she'll answer Judge Erdman's question.
Sure. You've used the phrase substitute expert a number of times. I'd like you to tell me precisely what it is you mean when you use substitute expert, because the phrase is used in many different opinions and seems to mean very many different things. So I'd like to know what you mean by it.
Yes, Your Honor, and I noted I'll answer those two questions on rebuttal. To go back to Judge Erdman's question, giving an example where Dr. Papa specifically relies on the testimonial statement, in page 136 of the joint appendix, Dr. Papa is testifying and explaining for the members, again, the run log that occurs and appears, at least one of them is at page 339 of the joint appendix. And in his testimony, he specifically describes for the members what occurred during the run, why the analysts had to make the notes that they did, and explains to the members the purpose of the analyst notes. So that's just one example of where he tied his testimony directly to some of the testimonial statements, because again, that analyst was handwritten notes, was making, talking about the accuracy of the run and making basically, in essence, declarations about the accuracy of the run in that particular instance.
Did he testify as to the results during that?
He did testify as to the results at one point in the record, and I may need to get that back to you specifically on rebuttal. I think it's at page 161, page 162 area. He's asked by trial counsel specifically what were the results of the test. And he then basically said, if the results are the fact that his nanogram level was X, and again, I would need to, but that was...
But in answering that, he did not specify which portion of the testing package that he was relying upon.
No, he did not, Your Honor, and he did not provide any type of explanation as to how he independently arrived at that conclusion, as you see in some of the other courts, such as Ban from the Alaska, where that expert actually independently.
Counsel, given the flow of the argument now, if you would prefer to answer Judge Ryan's question at this time so that all, including the government, would have the benefit of it, you may go ahead and do that now.
Yes, Your Honor. A substitute expert is somebody who had no independent knowledge of the actual testing of the sample itself. It's someone who was brought in, performed a technical review, meaning that they just looked at the reports. It wasn't necessarily contemporaneous peer review, as you see in some of the cases. And the substitute expert is then put on the stand to testify about the testing conclusions, the accuracy of the testing, and then to explain the basics of the testing process.
But I have a question for you, which is, under that definition, how could it be the case that and there could ever be an expert to testify about anything that came out of the laboratory?
I think one thing that distinguishes the facts of this case from that particular question goes to the fact that the testimony of hearsay was disclosed to the members. There's that line between...
But what happened in this case doesn't depend... Your definition of what a substitute expert is, as I understood it, didn't depend on what happened in this case. It was a generic description of, you know, anyone that comes in from outside and does an independent review of the underlying data and the procedures and forms an opinion on the basis. I'm just curious as to what in Melendez-Diaz you're relying on to suggest that you can't have a person testify based on non-testimonial hearsay that would be scientific evidence that was generally relied on by experts in the field in drawing a conclusion.
I think then to maybe add that extra step onto the definition that I provided to Your Honor would be the fact that substitute expert then discloses the testimonial hearsay. As far as the non-testimonial hearsay, again, that falls into the realm of 703, where 703 says that the expert shouldn't be disclosing this information to the members, and that's the problem that we have in this particular case.
But that's not a confrontation clause problem. That's a 703 problem. If it's non-testimonial.
If it's non-testimonial, yes, you're dealing with a 703 issue, not a confrontation clause issue. In the realm of testimonial hearsay, the courts have tied various 703 analysis as part of the confrontation clause analysis.
And then that gets back to my question in Gardner, which is, as I read Gardner on page 62, the D.C. Court of Appeals was suggesting there that if there had been appropriate instructions to the panel, the jury, as to how to address the expert testimony in light of the testimonial hearsay, that it would have been permissible in that case.
That is correct, Your Honor, where Gardner kind of then links in, well, if you instruct the members, we don't have any particular instruction that occurred here, and so it kind of now falls into the realm of what the court said in Gardner about the fact that there was this impossible feat of mental gymnastics.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. You have further opportunity on rebuttal. What we'll do now is we'll add 5 minutes to the government's time. I'm not encouraging you to take it, but in fairness to the time that was given, you'll have 25 minutes now.
May it please the Court. Colonel Christensen and I have the privilege of representing the Air Force before you today. Before turning to the two specified issues of the Court, we assert the portions of the DTRs past the top portion of the cover pages are non-testimonial hearsay because they are raw data generated by machines, and the military judge correctly admitted them and Dr. Papa's expert testimony under Crawford, Magliari, and the Fourth Circuit's Washington case.
I don't hear the appellant disputing that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I don't think the appellant is disputing that fact.
No, Your Honor. I just wanted to briefly touch on that and now turn to the specified issues. First, with regard to the testimonial cover page, Dr. Papa's testimony satisfied the confrontation clause because he was a qualified expert who relied upon raw data from machine-generated drug test results and provided his independent conclusion that appellant's two drug specimens contained drugs.
But I'm sorry, counsel. Are you suggesting that because of the things that you just said, that makes the cover page of the drug testing reports acceptable?
No,
that
no,
means
no,
that
no.
His testimony is making that page acceptable, or that are you arguing that his testimony was okay?
That's the second trial.
Okay, because it sounded like you were saying the first, and I had some questions for you about that.
I understand, Your Honor. No, we're not disputing this court's prior determination that the cover pages are testimonial. Not at all, Your Honor. Second, even if it was error to admit the testimonial cover page and Dr. Papa's testimony did not satisfy the confrontation clause, it was harmless error when analyzed under 703 and the harmless error factors.
Are you arguing that his testimony was permissible because he was an independent expert, or are you arguing that it was permissible because he was involved with the lab as a certifier and somebody who was familiar with it?
Well, he was qualified to give his expert opinion because, under the facts of this case, he had appropriate knowledge of the lab, of the test, and of all the procedures. However, his ultimate opinion is permissible under the Sixth Amendment because he gave an independent determination that, in his expert opinion, those two specimens contained drugs. So it's a little bit of both, Your Honor.
Well,
he was a qualified expert who gave his independent ultimate opinion.
In Pendergast and Turner, there we had testimony from supervisors, lab supervisors, who also participated in the test. Here we have a certifier who takes a test after the fact and looks at the paperwork and says everything appears to be fine. And I guess here he also looked at one of the sample bottles. But is there a distinction there that we should be looking at, or as far as you're concerned, does this fall into that realm?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that Dr. Papa actually conducted two technical reviews of the drug tests at issue. One, when he reviewed the test and signed the certification on the cover page under penalty of perjury.
And that certification, other than saying that this is a true and correct copy of these documents, what else did that say?
Your Honor, I think he went further than just that, and I would refer you to Joint Appendix page 59, where he testified, "I'm basically looking at the pages, looking at the drug testing report, to see if it is complete, to see if everything is there, and more significantly, and to see if the results follow and they are current." We don't believe he was just saying all the pages are in the package, but to see if the results followed, in his opinion.
But the certification itself on the documents don't go that far.
The certification itself does not say that. It's his testimony in the record, Your Honor, that I'm relying upon.
That's not too much different from what a clerk might say who's a certifying official, is it? I understand the phrase about that you pointed to at the end. That doesn't really tell us very much about what it was he analyzed at that point, as opposed to the testimony that he gave later.
Very true point, Your Honor. His testimony later on was much more detailed, much more thorough, to support his ultimate conclusion. But my point is, I want to demonstrate that he was, in fact, a qualified expert. He wasn't an interloper. He wasn't really an outsider, as he's been characterized by the appellant in this case.
On the Form 2624, what is your view with respect to the signatures at the bottom, which is the signature from the laboratory certifying official?
Your Honor, our position is these are machine-generated tests. Yes, there are.
Is there a machine-generated signature?
No, Your Honor, it's not. That is, I guess, the phrase that some of the appellate courts have used is the signature of a scrivener who is reporting the results that were independently determined only by the machine. That person who signed that didn't determine that there were drugs in this specimen. It was the machine that did that.
The person has determined that they've been correctly determined by proper laboratory procedures and they are correctly annotated.
That's correct.
So the machine correctly determines the proper laboratory procedure as well as whether they're correctly annotated. That's all machine done?
No, Your Honor. It's the machine that determines the result. It's the scrivener that reports it.
So if Melendez-Diaz is ultimately a case about affidavits.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why is this not an affidavity kind of thing?
Well, Your Honor, Melendez-Diaz did not address the question that's before us today. Melendez-Diaz simply doesn't require confrontation of lab technicians who administer machine-generated results that are later relied upon by testifying experts who render their independent opinions and conclusions. The Supreme Court simply did not address that question in Melendez-Diaz, and they certainly didn't decide it. It simply held that you can't have trial by affidavits, something that did not happen here. Melendez-Diaz left wide open the opportunity to present expert testimony and test results.
Right, but let's say you're wrong, and I'm going toward more toward issue one.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I'm also intrigued as to where Melendez-Diaz may or may not drive the labs. Will the labs then move to a process where people aren't involved and no one's checking the machines because they don't want to have someone come in and talk about it? That may or may not be a good thing, depending on how you look at it. So is it your position that that is, what is that signature on a 2-6, whatever this thing is, a 2-6?
It's a chain of custody form is what it is titled at the top, Your Honor. And yes, there are handwritten annotations on it, but we assert those are the actions of the scrivener who is making an official report of a machine-generated result.
And merely record, by scrivener you mean someone who doesn't think or do, but just records?
Well, no, Your Honor. I'm not suggesting that they are without a brain in their head or anything like that. I'm saying that they did not independently determine that these were positive drug tests. The machines did.
Could Dr. Papa be the scrivener?
He could.
I mean, he wasn't, but could he
could.
Be?
I think he could. Anybody at the lab appropriately trained and certified could do that.
Does the record reflect whether this person participated in the drug tests or merely recorded down what they did, what they recorded? I can't pronounce the name. Zacharides?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Could you repeat that question?
Yeah.
Sorry.
I can't even say it.
Not the name, but the question.
These people who fill in signature block one, do they actually touch, feel, and use the machines, or are they merely sitting up there and writing their name in these blocks after somebody else has done the analysis?
I don't know if that's reflected in the record, Your Honor. I'm not sure I'm able to answer that question.
Counsel, I'd like to see if you would agree or could supplement what I've tried to identify as the four potential witnesses in this case. The first would be the hearsay declarant, that is the person who ran the test or performed it. Secondly would be a substitute declarant, a person at the lab who did not actually run the test but was somehow otherwise involved in the test. The third would be a lab-specific expert, that is, a person who has responsibilities at the lab for supervising the tests as a whole, but didn't have any particular involvement in this test and looked at it retrospectively. And the fourth would be a general expert, that is, someone who had no involvement with the lab at all, but as an expert in the area, reviewed all the materials and renders an opinion. Here, I'm trying to decide whether Dr. Papa, which one of those categories he fits in. It doesn't appear that he had any particular involvement in the test itself, that after the test was run, he then did a certification, which would possibly, according to the argument you made earlier, make him a lab-specific expert. But if he's not a lab-specific expert, then it appears that he's at least a general expert in the case. That is, someone who has knowledge of this area can testify to it. Is your argument one that you're making in the alternative that he's either a lab-specific expert because of his supervisory role there, or if he's not, he's a general expert, and that the testimony was sufficient to meet the requirements for a general expert?
Well, Your Honor, that's a bit of a challenge of a question to answer.
In that
he kind of bleeds over into different areas there. He did, in fact, sign as an authorizing lab certifying official as to the bottle in Prosecution Exhibit 9, the random drug test. So we can't say he had no involvement.
But wasn't that after the fact? That is, the test was completed, and then he makes a certification when there's a request at that point.
I didn't believe that to be the case, Your Honor. Referring to Joint Appendix page 330, Dr. Papa signed on June 13, 2006, that he reviewed the bottle label on that particular specimen. And I interpret that to mean as the testing was in progress, if you will.
Okay.
It's later when he signs the cover page on August 16th that he signs as the lab certifying official, signing off on the drug testing report. So you'll see his signature really three times.
So he could actually be the substitute declarant at that point. That is someone who is making a statement about what others have reported.
That seems a fair assessment, Your Honor.
So he could have testified in all three capacities. Which one is the one that the government is relying on here? Are you relying on all three? That is, whether he is the substitute declarant by purposes of by virtue of his certification, whether he's a lab-specific expert who knows something about what goes on in that lab and has a supervisory role, or is he a general expert?
Well, Your Honor, substitute expert is a little bit of a misnomer in here because we don't contend that any of the people who participated in the test are necessarily experts.
And I didn't use that term here.
And therefore, it's a little awkward to call him a substitute. Our position, as clear as I can make it, is he's a qualified expert under 702, 3, and 5, who is sufficiently armed with information to give an expert opinion.
Then is it the government's position that a person who has no involvement with the laboratory whatsoever, but he has the complete access to the information, can give an opinion in court as to the content of a particular test, and that testimony from the expert would be sufficient to support a conviction?
Well, of course, those facts are not in this record, but it would seem in an appropriate case, if proper qualifications were demonstrated, that, yes, such an expert could be permitted under the Confrontation Clause to so testify.
What do we do if we have a general expert who is testifying as to the results, and that expert relies on testimonial evidence that was not subjected to the Confrontation Clause? For instance, in this case, the upper part of the two affidavits that are at pages 317 and 445, those upper portions appear to be testimonial.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if, in fact, Dr. Pappas reviewed those and relied upon that information, where does that leave us? Considering he looked at everything. You know, I mean, that's the difficult issue.
Yes, Your Honor. I guess the best way for me to approach that is the document custodians who signed the cover pages did in fact give testimonial information because it was...
Well, they're results reporting assistants. You call them document custodians, but that's just part of their duties. They're identified on the document as results reporting assistants.
But, Your Honor, that's the only role they played in these drug testing reports. You will not find their names anywhere else in these drug testing report packages.
So that title is a misnomer.
Document custodian is...
No, not document custodian, but they're identified as results reporting assistants. I mean, obviously, that has some significance.
Yes, Your Honor. They are the individuals who gathered up all the machine-generated graphs from the appropriate secure storage at the lab, put it all together, and then presented it ultimately to Dr. Papa so he could sign off on it. And yes, they did summarize which tests were done and what the outcomes were.
Which is a little more than document custodians, and you continue to refer to them as document custodians, somehow minimizing their role in it, but that's not what's reflected on the papers.
Well, yes, Your Honor, in that role, though, they're acting as scriveners who are reporting the results of these machine-generated tests.
Well, counsel, Your Honor. Let me ask you to assume for the sake of today's argument that the court disagrees with you and that we think that those portions of the documents were testimonial accusations that this individual had in fact used drugs, okay? Do you agree or disagree that particular portion of the document could not properly be admitted under the Confrontation Clause in light of Melendez-Diaz and Crawford unless those two individuals themselves testified?
Well, no, Your Honor, we would rely upon Pendergrass for the proposition that information could be admitted under the circumstances of this case.
So you reload what language in Melendez-Diaz or Crawford supports that? Because as I read those cases, it does not, those cases make quite clear that they do not, that the fact that someone else could testify equally as well or as reliably is of absolutely no moment.
I would agree, Your Honor. Melendez-Diaz gives us precious little guidance on that point. But I think if we look at the case law since that time, cases that the Supreme Court itself has denied cert on.
Well, what precedential value does the denial of cert have?
Well, I accept that, Your Honor.
I mean, it has zero.
I accept that, but what we do know is that they are persuasive cases. They're applicable to the facts that are presented here, and frankly, they should resolve the issue.
Well, I realize that they're persuasive from the government's perspective because they support the position that you would like us to adopt, but what I'm asking you is what in Crawford and Melendez-Diaz supports a proposition that the fact that someone else could reliably repeat what someone else said makes them the proper declarant for cross-examination?
Well, I would agree with you. Melendez-Diaz contains nothing because, frankly, Melendez-Diaz does not answer the question here today.
Well, what about the language in Melendez-Diaz where they talk about the fact on page, 2536, where they say, respondent in the dissent may be right that there are other ways, and in some cases better ways, to challenge or verify the results of a forensic test, but the Constitution guarantees one-way confrontation.
Yes,
doesn't that suggest to you that the fact that someone else could testify to the same thing doesn't avoid the Confrontation Clause problem?
We would agree that that provision of Melendez-Diaz leaves open to exactly what happened in this case, and that is the government produced a qualified expert who relied upon such information to give an ultimate expert opinion.
But you would agree that that's a different question. That's the second issue, not the first issue. The second specified issue. You're talking now about the second specified issue in this case as opposed to the first specified issue in this case.
No, Your Honor. We think that that portion of Melendez-Diaz would stand for the proposition as further supplemented by the arguments that we're seeing in Pendergrass that is not a violation of the Confrontation Clause itself.
What is not a violation of the Confrontation Clause?
The fact that an expert relied upon something that was testimonial from another witness because 703 permits him or her to do that.
And to repeat it?
Well, there may be some disagreement in the case law about that point. Either it's been permitted or it's been determined to be harmless.
Is 703 then a Crawford trapdoor?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You arguing 703 is a Crawford trapdoor?
I'm not.
Well, you just get in all the testimonial stuff then through the expert. I think that's where Judge Ryan's going.
The Confrontation Clause would not be violated, so
So it is a trapdoor, in your view?
I guess so,
yeah,
Your Honor.
Maybe my metaphors are no good.
If Papa's testimony satisfies the Confrontation Clause, do we need to reach Issue 2?
No, Your Honor. Issue 2 is not applicable if we resolve Issue 1 in the government's favor.
Can you interpret statements that were made under circumstances which would lead an objective witness reasonably to believe that the statement would be available for use at a later trial? Would be available for use at a later trial? If someone has a lab technician writes down the results and they're positive, Why should they objectively think that would be available for use at a later trial or not?
Well, Your Honor,
if they're in a military lab that's doing health and readiness as well as criminal, now
we would rely upon Maggiari for the proposition that the better view is they believe that they would have reasonably believed they were performing routine, unobjective recording of machine-generated data.
And but it would be available at a later trial, would it not?
But then that gets us into the questions and the issues we talked about at the last argument. Are there other possible outcomes besides court-martial prosecution? And of course there are. Even Dr. Papa talked about administrative discharge and Article 15 possibilities. We also spoke last time about the blind quality controls. And once again, the lab techs don't know if they're even testing a real military member specimen at the time that they're conducting it. They have no possible way of knowing what's blind quality and what's real. And therefore, it's difficult to say they reasonably would expect that what they're doing is bearing
testimony. When the screening did you have a follow-up, Judge Baker?
I might. Go ahead.
When the screening test is completed, and now it's being sent to the GCMS test, what does the lab tech know at that point? They know that there may be a blind quality control, and they may know that there's a presumptive positive in there.
Yes, Your Honor.
But they know that there are no confirmed negatives at that point. Is that correct?
No, I'm not sure that's true, Your Honor. I think there may be some negative.
What does the record show?
As well.
Yeah, they're quality controls.
Right.
And does the lab tech know at that point that anything that is confirmed positive by the GCMS will be sent to a military commander for purposes of exercising prosecutorial discretion as to whether that service member will have his or her situation disposed of through administrative, non-judicial, or criminal means?
They will know that if they think this specimen was actually a military member's as opposed to a blind quality control.
Thank you.
Counsel, as I see it, there's two possible ways that this could be, which is one, you could have an expert opinion that includes in the opinion testimonial statements made by others, okay? Or you could have an expert opinion that may or may not have relied on testimonial statements by others, but simply gives its own opinion based on reviewing data X, Y, and Z. My expert opinion is whatever it is. Which case is this? Or do you think it matters?
I'm not sure that it does, Your Honor.
So you don't think that in one case where someone repeats testimonial statements of others, declarants who themselves are not subject to cross-examination, you don't think that implicates a confrontation clause, whereas the other one may or may not?
Well, that draws me back to 703, because that's the kind of data that experts in this field reasonably rely upon.
But you don't think that there's a difference between relying on something and repeating it verbatim in one's own testimony?
There, some courts have drawn such a distinction. Some have not found a problem with that.
But I'm asking you the government's position in this case as to whether there's a distinction and whether it makes a difference, and if so, why or why not?
Well, I don't think that it, Your Honor, the government doesn't think that it does make a difference, because at the end of the day, the defense and this appellant got the best possible person on the stand to confront the evidence that was being used against
him. But that goes back to pre-Crawford, where the test was reliability. Was the evidence reliable? Was it the best evidence available, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera? And Crawford flatly rejected that mode of analysis. And Melendez-Diaz rejected it, too. So the fact that this person who testified could have known everything possible and been the best person in the world, I think does not make them the declarant of testimonial statements. And I don't think that there's anything in Melendez-Diaz or Crawford that suggests that would be okay. I agree that pre-Crawford it would have been absolutely fine, and that would have been precisely the question that we would be asking.
Well, Your Honor, in the cases that we cited, we believe there is clearly a trend in favor of being able to rely upon testimonial information, such as we saw on the cover page like this, and even disclosing it. We think there is sufficient authority for this court to so hold.
Counsel, based on your response to Judge Ryan, It sounds like you're arguing that 703 somehow alters or affects the Confrontation Clause. I mean, how do you see that relationship? Because you keep coming back and saying, well, it would be okay under 703 because they always are able to rely on inadmissible evidence.
Yes, Your Honor. There is some bleed over in issues 1 and 2 with 703. Certainly there's a 703 harmless error analysis, but 703 can't be ignored as well when talking about expert qualifications in the first place.
But when you're doing the Confrontation Clause analysis, how does, in your view, 703 factor in?
Well, Your Honor, as in any expert's opinion, the appropriate inquiry, did the expert rely upon proper material in forming an expert opinion or not? So 703 has got to play a role in both the issues before this court.
But it can't play an exclusive role, can it? That is, in a drug, in a drug prosecution, you have to prove wrongful use. And an expert's testimony isn't sufficient to prove wrongful use unless you've introduced some evidence of the use. That is, somehow the drug test has to come into evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so whether that is or is not inadmissible hearsay is always going to be at issue, isn't it?
I guess it is, Your Honor. Yes.
Thank you. You may briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. At the end of the day, we stand on issue number one. We would briefly note there was no error for the factors that are outlined in the Van Arsdale case, especially when you consider the defense had their own expert who assisted them in the cross-examination of Dr. Papa.
No error or no prejudice?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
No error or no prejudice?
It was harmless error, Your Honor. Sorry. The prosecution's case was very strong against this appellant. He had two positive drug tests in a very short time. He had slim to no chance for an acquittal with or without the cover pages, and his admissions sealed his fate. At the end of the day, the decades-long practice of prosecuting drug cases with an expert and a drug test remains constitutionally permissible, and the appellant's conviction should be affirmed. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. And to quickly go back to your question about Gardner with the limiting instruction, the D.C. Court of Appeals did leave open that particular question as to what would happen with if a limiting instruction had been given in that case. I think there's still some chance for danger in those situations where the members, if they were given such type of an instruction, they would still have to find that the accuracy of the reports is there, which again ties more into substantive evidence versus going to just the underlying basis.
So is it your view that if the only pieces of evidence introduced would be the following, raw computer printouts and expert testimony interpreting those printouts, that would be a Confrontation Clause violation unless you produce people who actually observed the printouts and said something about it?
I think where you start to run into that danger of is reliance versus disclosure, whereas here when you have that type of situation with those graphs, again, going back to the point earlier that I made, is the graphs aren't in a vacuum. Like, we don't reach that point without an analyst then coming back and saying that those were...
Why can't the expert testify to that? An expert who's had absolutely nothing to do with the laboratory, but someone who's an expert in drug analysis, why can't that person come in, review the raw data, and give an opinion as to whether it's a positive or not?
And I think that's where you then run into the problem of the what-ifs when it comes to the accuracy of the data that the expert is relying on.
That goes to the weight of the evidence. It doesn't go to whether it's admissible. And the risk you're running is you're driving this towards a process, if you prevail on every issue you've stated, where the government's going to have an incentive to just bring in graphs and have some expert read the graphs. And you won't even know who tested them. You will have no way to figure out whether there is fraudulent results, where there is somebody down there mucking around. Now, Crawford may require that. Are you sure that's what you want?
I think the problem, the quandary that's facing us is even when you take a look at the graphs, where we get to that point where there's graphs is where you still don't have the ability to test. It's kind of that garbage.
That's a different issue. I mean, the question, as I understood the Chief Judge's question to you, was if all you had was raw computer printouts and an expert that relied on those printouts and gave the opinion that it was that person's urine was positive for a illegal drug metabolite, there's no confrontation clause issue with respect to that. Now, what you're saying is, oh, but there's other problems because, you know, we don't know if those tests are reliable. But that's not a confrontation clause issue because you don't have a testimonial statement to quibble about. You have an expert testimony, an expert testifying about his own opinion. What would preclude the defense if they wanted to call a witness to probe the reliability of the test from calling those witnesses? Do you see what I'm saying? They're two totally different issues.
I understand, Your Honor. About the two totally different, and I see that my time is up. If I may
answer the question and then briefly conclude.
When it comes to that type of situation, I think that's the problem we see in labs where there's been the expert is relying on the faulty information being the graphs where data may have been manipulated, and that's the problem in like North Carolina, New York, and Texas, where they've seen some of these problems with faulty analysis, kind of a garbage in, garbage out type of situation.
So you cross-examine the expert about the garbage in, garbage out, and they either say you're right or they say we have no idea, and then what weight is their testimony going to be given? And I'm just saying the opportunity to cross-examine the person who's actually testifying is there.
That is correct, Your Honor. But I guess I still take that position of is the expert is relying on so many assumptions about those graphs that's where that issue becomes, because the declarants down at the lab, they're more than mere scriveners that the government says they are. They are performing a qualitative analysis about those graphs when they certify them out as being positive. And that's the part, while yes, there may be raw graphs, you still run into the confrontation issue when to declare as to the qualitative nature of those graphs.
Would you have a problem if Dr. Popp had gone and read all the graphs before trial and signed the thing himself?
I think it's a very different situation because then he's performing an independent analysis and he can then testify for the members about that independent analysis, which he did not do.
The mistake for the government, in your view, was that he signed the bottom rather than the top of the document?
I just want to make sure I'm understanding Your Honor's question. In that type of situation, you're saying he'd be signing the top as a basically in the role of a reporting result.
He is an expert. He can read the graph. So why not just have him? Forget having a couple of sets of people do it. Why doesn't the government just have him sign everything?
I think at that point you have a different scenario than what we have here what is the current practice of the lab, because in that case...
No, I understand it's different. Would it satisfy Crawford?
I think when you have that point, then if Dr. Papa has walked through and maybe been present for the testing and the review...
Let me restate it. If Dr. Papa can honestly say that he did everything that Zacharides and the two recording people did, could he satisfy Crawford by signing all those things?
I think you're still gonna have a problem under Crawford and confrontation. For example, this court could take judicial notice of a case before it, Scrady, where a false positive is reported by an LCO and wasn't caught till much later. Whereas in a situation like that, we still may run into a problem with a
case-specific problem, though, but not a general problem.
And again, I think it would depend on a case-by-case, fact-by-fact analysis of what occurred at the lab. And I do see that I'm over my time. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:50 a.m.
All rise.